You're listening to High Control, a podcast about identifying, leaving, and recovering from high control, high demand groups, also known as cults. We're not experts, but we do know what it's like to be a part of and then leave a cult. Your high control journey starts now.
Welcome to the High Control Podcast. My name is Scott Lloyd, along with my friend Ali Henney, and I'm hosting the program today. And on this episode, we are talking about joining a cult. I showed up to worship Jesus, but all I got was this lousy trauma. And what our podcast is all about is high control religious groups and other cults, and we share our experiences in hopes that others will be encouraged to share their experiences as well, or to leave some of these high control and cult groups. And today, my friend Ali is going to be sharing some of her experiences. And Ali, just knowing you and knowing your personality and your temperament, I can just envision that bright-eyed young lady that says, "Hey, I'm here to serve. I'm here to worship Jesus. I'm passionate about Jesus." And all of a sudden, you feel the control clamping down on your style. Was it like that for you?
It was exactly like that. It was exactly like that. And, you know, I will say this, and I'm probably being too hard on myself in this, but, you know, there's an old saying that God looks after fools and babies. And I was both. The first time that I was involved with a high control group was whenever I was in college. And so I was 19 years old and, you know, on my own for the first time. I was engaged. I was engaged to my high school sweetheart and just, you know, kind of trying to take on the world or whatever. So I was very young. And so with that youth also came just inexperience and a lack of knowledge, but then also a very kind of, you know, willing and trusting heart that led me into my first, and of course, I am a repeat. It's like my personality is not the person that joins cults, but then I'm like, you know, but am I the person that joins cults? Is that who I am? Should I just own that? But no, I'm not. There were circumstances, there were things that hopefully make sense, that I wasn't just like out here like, oh, I'm just, because again, we talked about this in another episode. Nobody joins a cult. Like, nobody just says, oh, hey, I'm going to join something that is going to be harmful for me. You're joining something because you feel like it's a good thing. And like I said, you know, I was young, I was inexperienced, I was naive. I thought in each case where I joined this type of group, I thought that I was joining something that was going to be doing something great for Jesus. And I wanted to be there and I wanted to be part of that. And as a 19-year-old, you know, I was somebody like, I grew up in the church. But my family, the even better way to say it is that I grew up in the Christian faith. My family was kind of in and out of going to church, but my family was were very strong believers in Jesus, very strong believers in God. My mom and my grandma were very instrumental in the formation and the development of my faith. I grew up going to a little Baptist church in the town that I grew up in. And then whenever I was in middle school, there had been the church that I had grown up in, there's just all kinds of different like drama and scandal and whatever. So there got to be a point when my mom just got tired of that, because anytime something would blow up, like we would kind of, you know, pull back from the church and there'd be a new pastor. Then we'd be there for a little bit. Then something else would inevitably happen. And so then we'd pull back a little bit. So my mom just got tired of that. And so we left the church that we had been part of. And my mom had actually been invited to a Pentecostal church. She didn't know, that's a whole other story. She didn't know that it was a Pentecostal church. She just knew, she met a Black preacher at a funeral and he invited her to church in the neighboring town. And so she decided that we would visit. And I knew it was Pentecostal because I saw it on the sign, but my mom like never saw it on the sign. Like she was terrified of Pentecostalism. Like she thought like Pentecostals were like snake handlers and that type of stuff. Like that was what she thought. Now my stepdad had grown up Pentecostal. And in fact, he had grown up United Pentecostal in Jamaica. And so like he was like, oh, it's a Pentecostal church. Okay. And like, but like he didn't say anything to her about it. And then it probably was like, you know, the third or the fourth time that we visited the church that then she happened to see the sign and saw that it said Pentecostal, and she was like, oh, okay, well, I guess that they're not out here drinking bleach and handling snakes, and it's very similar to the church that we came out of, so all right. So I grew up, again, you know, with the faith, going to this church, but I was pretty, like I love Jesus, but I was pretty ambivalent about church. Mm-hmm. And then especially like in my teenage years, you know, there wasn't, my church didn't really have a youth group. There wasn't really anything popping for kids my age. The church was like, you know, 40 minutes away from where I lived. So it was just kind of, is a lot of old people, like no offense to old people, but like, it was just like, I'm, you know, I'm a teenager.
Right.
And it's just like, you know, everybody else there is like, you know, in their like, my parents were like the next oldest people at the church besides me. And so like, there's just got to be a point where, you know, the people who were my age, their parents stopped making them come to church, but my mom still made me come to church and my mom still made me go, but everybody else's parents had made them stop going or had let them stop going. And so, but then whenever I was in high school, I just sort of had this awakening of faith and that's a whole other story in and of itself. But the long and the short of it is that I really, for the first time in my life, really, really started to own my faith and really started to take charge of my faith. And so then whenever I went off to college, I was ripe for the picking, right? Like I was ripe for the picking for a high control group because, you know, I was passionate about Jesus. I was somebody, you know, that in addition to going to college, in addition to my classes, you know, I spent a lot of time praying and reading my Bible and just really just wanted to show up in the world in a way that made a difference.
And I think that's important to point out that, you know, these kinds of groups don't appear out of nowhere. They don't happen in a vacuum. They are conditioned by the culture and by the circumstances and by the geography around them as we are as individuals. And so, you know, it's a perfect storm of sorts. If you have that disposition where you are wired to think about things on a deeper level or to love powerfully and deeply and to be emotionally involved and connected and committed, you typically end up gravitating towards these groups because that's the initial message that you receive, that these groups are different, that they're just like you, that they are special, and that they are committed to this cause, whatever that cause might be.
Yeah. And that cause, like, it, so the first thing that I joined was the United Pentecostal Church. And we've talked about the UPC in several episodes now. That's a well-worn path for us on this show. But the church that I was part of, and I think I referenced this in another episode, it was kind of more kind of the more liberal in big, huge quotes, because there were none liberal about that church. But in terms of like the dress standards, the holiness standards, or whatever have you, there were a lot less rules. And so I was aware of what the United Pentecostal Church was before I started going to that church. I was aware of what it was, and I was aware of some of the distinctives. But then the things that I saw whenever I started going to Truth, I saw that there were a couple of women there who wore pants. And so it was like, oh, so they're not gonna, and they were part of the church, I thought. And so I was like, okay, so they're not gonna like like, you know, throw you out for wearing pants. Like, people, it didn't seem like that people were staring at these women and judging them. I know that one of them even had been part of the church, I think, for a while. And so I was like, okay, like, that's, you know, cool. And, you know, I noticed that, like, men had beards, and I knew that that was like a big, you know, oh, you can't do that kind of thing. And so I was like, okay, well, this seems different. This seems different than what you typically would hear about in the United Pentecostal Church. And so I just thought, like, okay, I'll give it a try, because the Pentecostal church that I had come out of was a oneness Pentecostal church. And so there were some beliefs and stuff that were very different, that were very similar, rather. So, like, you know, believing and being baptized in Jesus' name, like, that was a big one for me, you know, like, oh, that's, at the time, I don't believe that way anymore. But at the time, it was like, oh, this is a church that does this. So, and it seems like, you know, they've got some younger people here. It doesn't seem like that they're quite as strict. And so just on the surface, that was really great for me. And then the pastor was young. He was, you know, he was charismatic, and he had this big idea of wanting to see God transform our city, and wanting to see people who were going to be transformed by Jesus. And one of the practical ways that sort of played out, or that he was, the vision that he was casting for this to play out in the church, was by going into one of the neighborhoods that our church was adjacent to, and, you know, providing things like school supplies and doing a turkey giveaway at Thanksgiving, and kind of doing some of these social justice type things with the aim of hopefully people coming to know Jesus out of it. And at the time, that appealed to me. And so I decided, you know, my fiance, then fiance, now husband, we dove into the church. We got really super involved. I learned pretty quickly that, like, oh, if you want to be involved in leadership here, then there's like there's a cultural expectation that you adhere to the holiness standards. Now, I did have a conversation with the pastor, and I can see what he was doing whenever he said this, because he was actually the church. I guess the spoiler alert of the story is that the church that I was a part of, that was part of the UPC, that church, the whole church, left the United Pentecostal Church. And so that pastor led the congregation out of the United Pentecostal Church. It created, there were people who left the church. It created a lot of controversy. It was a very harrowing experience in a lot of ways. And he had only been pastoring the church whenever my husband and I had come, he had only been pastoring this church for about 6 months. And so, but he had been the youth pastor there for several years before that, but he was like the senior pastor, had only been the senior pastor for about 6 months. And so whenever I had a conversation with him about the standards, because I was kind of like, you know, like, what are the expectations here, whatever, something that he said to me is he was like, you know, I don't really care what you do outside of church, but, like, whenever you come to church, like, you know, can you wear a skirt? Like, if you're going to be able, or it wasn't even whenever I came to church. It was like, because I could play the drums and they needed a drummer for Wednesday night. It was like, you know, whenever you're up on the platform, like, you know, you can't wear pants, like you've got to wear a skirt, but I don't really care what you do outside of church. And I realize now that was him, like, trying to create a situation that would force the issue for the congregation, that would help the congregation progress along. Right. And also, I think that it was him, like, realizing, like, oh, I have, like, young people, I have talented young people here, and I don't want these standards to drive them away. So I had heard that directly from the pastor. But then, like, some of my peers and stuff in the church, others within the church, reinforced to me that, like, actually being seen outside of church wearing pants, that is, like, a huge no-no. And if you're, like, a member of the church and somebody sees that, then you could end up, like, basically, like, this was, like, a thing back then, and then the church stopped doing it even before we left the UPC, but it was a thing for a couple of years, for my first couple of years whenever I was at the church, that, like, you wouldn't be able to vote at the business meeting. Like, so like there was a thing, and it was like, and it was something that was like, honestly, it was really humiliating. And I was glad that it was a way to humiliate people. And I'm actually glad that we kind of stopped doing it, is there'd be a list that they put up on the bulletin board during business meeting time. And like, if your name wasn't on the list, it meant that you weren't a member of the church and that you couldn't vote. And so all the people who weren't on the list, yep, didn't matter what they did in the church. If your name wasn't on that list and you talked to the pastor about it, it was probably either A, because you weren't paying your tithes and your offerings, or B, right, it was because somebody had, you know, seen you out at Walmart and you were wearing pants, or they caught you out, you know, someplace that you weren't, yep, supposed to be, like the movie theater or something like that. And so I was just kind of like, you know, I'm just the type of person that it was like, okay, I guess I didn't necessarily agree with it, but it was just kind of like, oh, this is what, yeah, I want to do to babe. I want to fit in. I like this place. I don't want to do anything to upset the apple cart. So I guess I'll just, you know, follow the standards. So that was what I did.
Yeah. And, you know, that's really an important point to make, because what was true for your church and my church, it may vary from church or group, but every high control group, every cult has to have a means for policing their members, for controlling their members. And a lot of times you will hear leaders in these groups pay lip service to, you know, people choose to be here. Mm-hmm. People, you know, they want to dress like this. They want to behave like this. And that's a form of propaganda, mm-hmm, which is proclaimed by leaders to condition the group to fit in. Because if you are divergent, or if you do disagree, or you behave differently or act differently, then it creates this dichotomy between the insiders and the outsiders. And so no one ever has to say from the pulpit or from the platform or even on a personal level, hey, you have to do this to fit in. Because if you are observant and you do want to fit in, then you are going to mimic what others are doing. Specifically, you are going to aspire to behave like the leaders that you see consistently day in and day out. And that's one of the reasons why most of these pastors have a different set of rules for those that are on the platform and those that aren't. Mm-hmm. The reason they do that is because what is seen is what is duplicated. So they want people to see those that are privileged to be in leadership, those that are privileged to be on the platform. And the unspoken word is, if you want to be like this, then do likewise.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because you just like triggered a memory in my mind of like platform standards. So they were just like, right, the, yeah, standards, the general, yeah, standards that everybody was expected to adhere to. And then there were platform standards, which were like, you know, a higher level of commitment, I suppose. And platform standards, they were literally just for being on the platform, even though some people lived platform standards their whole, you know, every day. And so like I said, you know, my church, it had a lot of less strict, they were still strict, but less strict rules than what was typical. So like at one point, whenever I first started going to Truth, platform standards meant that like women had to wear hosiery whenever you were on the platform. And I remember there was one time that like it was probably maybe, you know, 2 or 3 years after I started going there. I remember my pastor came into choir rehearsal and was like, yeah, y'all ain't gotta wear pantyhose anymore. And so I was like, I took my pantyhose, like I took my little knee highs off right then and there. I was like, oh great, we don't have to do this. Boop, it's off. I'm done. I'm not wearing hose on the platform. So that was like one thing there's reasons for it, but it was super duper arcane. But this idea that like, so for me, you know, the idea of the standards, like what I kept on hearing, you talk about propaganda, the things that I kept on hearing from people was, oh, it's a choice. I'm doing this, you know, it's a higher level of discipleship. It's all this other type of stuff. Well, like in my mind, and I guess this is maybe some of my pathology, like I wanted to be close to Jesus. And so that's it. Like that was it. And so you're telling me that if I don't wear pants, that like, and I only wear a skirt, so like not walking around like naked or anything, but like if I wear only skirts, that is somehow going to make me closer to Jesus. I don't understand it. But again, you know, being a baby, being young, not having a lot of life experience, I've got these women, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years older than me, you know, telling me, and some of them not even people that grew up in the church, like people, you know, telling me that people who were converts, like saying, you know, yes, I did this, and this is what it did in my life, and this is what's whatever. You know, I had somebody tell me, you know, yeah, you know, like wearing a skirt, you know, it provides a sense of protection for me, and this is all like rape culture type stuff, FYI.
Yeah.
But you know, it provides a sense of protection. You know, people treat me like a lady and like all this other type of stuff. And like, I didn't really care about that. Like I didn't really care about that, but I was also like, it didn't make any difference to me, like in that way. But that was something that I was told. And I remember like after she told me that, I remember noticing, 'cause I was in college at the time. I remember noticing like people would hold the door open, like men would hold the door open for me and stuff. And that actually kind of irritated me. I didn't want them, like, because I mean, you know, I'm feminist. Like, I didn't actually like want people to treat me differently because I wore a skirt. But then I was like, oh, but then like just the way that it was rationalized was like, oh, but you know, they see that you're this and that and whatever. So I'm like, oh, it's because I'm holy? That's still weird, but okay. Like, and so I'm just like, it's like, this is what you're telling me, that there's going to be like all these benefits and whatever to this. So this is why I'm doing this. But really what it came down to is I wanted to fit in. I wanted to belong. Mm-hmm. I saw how they talked about the women who didn't do the thing and how it'd be like, you know, oh yeah, like Stacy, I saw her at Walmart and she was wearing capri pants and she had her toenails painted. And it's like, and everybody's like, yo, gasp. And it's like, and well, I didn't want people talking about me like that. Like, you know, I felt, and so I think the other thing too that I need to say here that I didn't say is that I felt a call to ministry. And mm-hmm. I felt that call to ministry, my call to ministry predated my involvement at any UPC church. My call to ministry, it came really even outside of like a traditional church context. And so I saw the opportunity at Truth to serve and to lead. And I wanted to be able to live into and live out my calling. And so I was just sort of, I reasoned with myself like, okay, like this is, you know, wearing a skirt or not cutting my hair or like having, you know, to put my jewelry away. Like maybe that's a small price to pay for what I feel like I'm called to do in my life.
And that's so interesting because specifically as it has to do with women, these kinds of regulations and rules, what they refer to as holiness standards, basically, especially for women, reduced them to what they put on their body. And so it was a reduction of sorts. So you weren't valued for your thoughts. You weren't valued for your contributions. All of that could only be accessed via your conformity to how you mm-hmm. adorned your body. And of course, that speaks of larger issues within the culture, but it's amazing how patriarchy and misogynist ideas are enforced and how they evolve when they are wrapped in religious language. It's still a reduction of women to simply their bodies, but it's wrapped up in this, we want to say something to the culture. We want to show them a picture of what godly women look like and behave. But again, it's just a matter of control and behavior modification over time that continues to benefit males within the church.
Yeah, and that was 100% what it was. And it was, I went to a liberal arts college. I went to a secular liberal arts college that had a public affairs mission. So I was getting, you know, getting a healthy dose of, you know, of feminism, getting a healthy dose of kind of, you know, anti-oppression type thought and that sort of thing. I mean, at least as much as, you know, you could get from like a public university in the buckle of the Bible Belt. But there were, so a lot of even like what I was getting in college from that context was even in conflict with what I was hearing and stuff at church. And there was a lot of, like, you know, trying to reconcile like what I was being taught in the classroom with what I was hearing in the pulpit. And, you know, I was very, in my mind and to people who similarly were college educated and you know, had some of the same types of questions that I did, I was regularly questioning those things, was regularly pushing back against some of that. But then also just kind of knowing like this is a church, you know, this organization has existed longer than I've been alive. And, you know, it even like has existed longer than my parents were alive. And so like I knew what I was kind of going up against. But even with that said, I was a youth pastor, I was a youth worker, and then I was a youth pastor. And there was, thankfully, kind of a move within my church to not be like forcing the next generation to do some of these things. Like in terms of like the youth group, like we were very, especially for a Pentecostal youth group, we were just very not like down with that. And so I think I've referenced this before, you know, we would take our kids to events and as much as we could, we would not have them follow the standard. So if there wasn't a handout saying, hey, you have to do this, we would not tell our students, we would not tell the teenagers and youth group, like, you have to dress this way. And so that always stirred up a lot of controversy because, you know, you have Truth Tabernacle walking into the youth event and girls are in pants and girls have cut and dyed hair. I remember one year we went to youth convention. We were probably like the largest group at youth convention. I think we had like 40 or 50 people at youth convention. I think we had something like 35 or 40 kids, and then there was a group of adults that went with them. And in years past, we were kind of like, you know, we would try to get some of the girls' skirts and that type of stuff, and, you know, make sure that they looked like it. Well, at that point, like, we had so many kids, and it was like, we can't all just go and be buying these kids a new wardrobe. And it's kind of silly to have to buy a kid a new wardrobe. Like, this is like, we're gonna buy them, you know, these skirts, and then they're not gonna like really ever wear them afterward. So we just showed up. And so at that point, and we were at, the church was on its way out of the UPC anyway. Like, we had already kind of like, yeah, we're kind of done with this as a church, and we were kind of on our way out. But we showed up, we had our little girls in there with their cut and dyed hair. I remember there was a girl who had dyed part of her hair blue, and so we got her like really dressed up. Like, I did her makeup with like the smoky eye, like her smoky eye was popping. She had her little bump up in the front, so she was kind of like wearing like the pseudo Pentecostal hairstyle with blue hair. And then she's wearing, so skinny jeans were popular, she was wearing skinny jeans, and then she had this pair, somebody like loaned her a pair of high heels. And so she was in there, and like, we did this with like several of the girls, and people were staring at us like they could not believe. And so then you got like youth leaders, and for me, it's like I still had, as like one of the youth leaders and stuff, I still had to wear a skirt. We weren't really like gonna be, you know, that controversial. But I mean, all of us, you know, all the women, we had our hair cut, we were wearing makeup or whatever, but we were wearing our Pentecostal skirt. And people, and that was like the last time that we went to that event, but people were like, oh my goodness. Like, this is, it was so controversial. It was so utterly controversial for us to do that and for us to step out that way. But that was kind of, you know, even a proud moment for me. Because again, like, we just thought, I really thought the whole time that like the standards and everything were junk. And so whenever we started the process of leaving the UPC, and it was a process. It was something that it took. It was from talking to other people who have been through similar things. For some people, you know, it was 3, 4, 5 years. My church did it in like a year. It was straight up like, and there's way more to the story, but basically, like, the pastor was like, he had been trying to rationalize, trying to whatever. He realized he could not teach the holiness standards anymore, so he stopped teaching the holiness standards. Then it just kind of, after a while, it just kind of became, you know, we just became like looser with different things. Like, they weren't enforcing certain things on the platform and whatever. There's a woman I remember that was the catalyst even for all of this. She had had a baby, and she had very, very long hair. She had hair almost like down to like her calves or whatever. She had had a late in life baby. And as does for many women, her hair started falling out after pregnancy. So her hair like started. So it's all this long hair like starts falling out. And she's just like, yeah, like that. Like, I look horrible. Like, she's like, my hair looks horrible. I want to trim my hair. Like, I don't even want to cut it off. I just want to trim it to where like it looks like something. This can't possibly be honoring God, right? Like, I cannot possibly be honoring God right now with the way my head looks. And so the pastor was just kind of like, I mean, I'm not going to tell you not to. And so she was like, bet, and cut her hair. And so she was a leader in the church. And so she shows up to church and she's got her hair trimmed. Everybody's like, and she was like, well, you know, pastor said I could do it. And people were like, and so then that just sort of started a domino effect. So then one of the board members' daughter had hair like literally down to the floor, and it was hurting her head. And so she was like, she was like, I think I'm going to cut my hair. Boom. She cuts her hair. And it just, and so it became this whole thing. Women started wearing pants outside of church, and it just became this whole snowball effect that then it was just sort of, it got to the point where it was basically like, okay, we have to leave. Like, we can't stay. Right. Like this is like, as a church, we are, and I'm telling a very truncated version of the story, but basically it got to the point where it was like, you know, we can't stay, and we can't stay in this group anymore. And so the whole church voted unanimously. We voted, we had that business meeting that all of us wouldn't have been eligible for, that none of us would have been eligible for several years before.
Right.
We had that business meeting, and we unanimously voted to leave the UPC. And since the church, since the organization didn't own our church, it was as simple as us voting and saying, we don't want to be up in this anymore. And that's what we did. And so we left. And that's how I left my first high control group.
And you're listening to the High Control Podcast. I'm Scott Lloyd, and we're hearing Allie Henney describe how she showed up to worship Jesus and received a lot of lousy trauma instead. And on the other side of this break, we're going to continue with Allie and her story about high control groups and other cult groups, and how she realized that all she was receiving was trauma in place of a lot of promises to get closer to God. We'll be back on the other side of this break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the High Control Podcast. I'm Scott Lloyd. I'm hosting this episode along with my friend Allie Henney. And Allie, you've been sharing some of your story, and we only have a limited amount of time, so we kind of have to fly through the details. But something that you said was really, really interesting. In this process of that UPC church exiting the UPC, you referenced this several times, that someone would go and ask the pastor, and when the pastor put his stamp of approval on some sort of behavior, or at least said, well, you know, I'm not going to tell you not to, then that behavior was deemed okay and acceptable, which is problematic in a lot of ways if you think about it as well, because in so many of these high control groups, one person was elevated to the place of a spiritual guru that gave permission, and whether you look at it as conservative or liberal or progressive, either way, when a group is reduced to being governed by the word or the whims of one single solitary leader, yeah, you're probably in a cult.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's like the grand irony of all this, that like leaving the cult meant doing cult stuff to get out of the cult. Like there is the irony is absolutely not lost on me. Like I think about, you know, it's like, you know, I was, you know, 25 or something like that. 20, it was 24, 25 or whatever, whenever we left. And the irony of like asking permission if I could cut my hair. Like, what? What? And like, I remember, you know, and this will be about the last thing I say about like the UPC thing that I was involved in, but something that was hilarious that I got a lot of, I want to say I got flack for it, but I did, but I didn't. The status quo was obviously changing. Like the status quo of the church was obviously changing, but I was a leader. And so I was a staff member of the church. So the progress kind of moved a little bit slower for staff members. So you got, you know, women wearing pants to church events outside of the church. You've got people cutting their hair and wearing makeup and wearing jewelry. But as a leader, I was asked, it was kind of like, okay, everybody else is doing this, but can you all not rock the boat while we're trying to like the pastor's trying to figure all this out, and he's like, you know, can y'all not rock the boat with this? So he's like, okay, yeah, sure, I'll keep wearing a skirt to church. But I would wear, so basically, because this was in fashion at the time, so this was like you late aughties, so it was in fashion to wear a dress and then to wear jeans under the dress. So I would wear a dress, and so I would buy the dress like, you know, a size or two up, so it would be, because I'm tall and long legged, so like what is an average dress, what would be below the knee for some people isn't for me, and so I would buy it like a size or two up, so I would make sure the dress came below my knees, and then I would wear my jeans, and then I would wear a pair of boots that came up to my knees. So you could see the jeans, but you couldn't really see the jeans, but I was kind of wearing the jeans kind of like they were leggings. So I was on fashion, on trend. And then like as soon as church was over, I would just take the dress off. So like I would have like a shirt or whatever on under the dress. I would just take the dress off. Literally as soon as church was over, boom, I'm done. I'm walking around the church doing my stuff. Because I was like, this is dumb. Or like I would wear, you know, stuff that was like clear, like I was making fun of what was happening. So like I was clearly like, this is ugly like as hell. Like I'm wearing this skirt over this pair of jeans with the rest of this outfit, and like it is like I'm wearing pants to church, y'all, but I have a skirt on because I am following the rules, because you told me what I'm supposed to do. So I'm following the rules, but I thought it was dumb. So I was like, well, this is like kind of my way of flouting the rules, because it didn't make sense. It's like, I'm wearing pants every other place. God is everywhere. God doesn't care what, if I'm wearing pants, like at Walmart, God doesn't care that I'm wearing pants at the church. So, you know, I found all these kind of ways to kind of flout the rules. But even the fact that I even had to do that I just like, you know, I'm at this point, I was a grown woman. I had a house, I had a mortgage, I was paying bills. Like, I mean, that's a big thing in the Black community. If you ain't paying my bills, like, then what? I mean, and to be fair, the church, I mean, I guess kind of was paying my bills, but they weren't the ones that was writing the check and sending it. So it's kind of like, you know, y'all ain't paying my light bills. So why should I listen to what you have to say? But yeah, the grand irony of all of that. But the trauma part of it, because I've kind of told the story in kind of, you know, lighthearted kind of tones, I really even have made the pastor look and sound way better than he actually was. So he was great, I guess, you know, with all of that, with that part of it. But as a person, he was, you know, working through some of his own trauma and was very unhealthy, was unhealthy often as a leader. And so some of the, and it really started to really, I started to see it, not so much, you know, before we were leaving the UPC, but kind of in the midst of it, there was a lot of really ugly stuff that happened that I think brought out some of the worst in him. And then afterward, just some of the, because you know, it was a free fall, right? Like, so it's like you're leaving, you know, this person is leaving, for him, he's leaving this denomination that he'd been in like his whole life. This church is going through all this stuff. There are people that are being horrible to him with that. And that's not an excuse for how he behaved toward anyone at all, but it is a framing for myself of understanding, yeah, there was all this, you know, really difficult stuff that was going on. And so then it manifested in how he treated or sometimes even like mistreated staff members. And so like, I'm just here again, I'm just here to worship Jesus. I'm just here to live out my calling or whatever. And then, you know, I've got you being a cult leader, basically. Mm-hmm. I've got you trying to control me. I've got you, like, this cult made this man think that he could raise his voice to me like this. And that's like Pentecostal, like United Pentecostal pastors, quiet as it's kept, some of those men are mean. And it is, absolutely. And it is something that is even esteemed in the culture. Like there's kind of like, now there's a point whenever it's like, oh, you can be too mean and then like people don't like you, but being mean was part of being mean, and like preaching at people in a way and talking to people in a way that was something that was expected in the culture. And that's what this man did. And I experienced a lot of that culture of just being very, very direct and plain spoken and controlling in a way that wasn't helpful, that wasn't uplifting. I mean, not that any of those things really can ever be helpful or uplifting, but I was the recipient of a lot of that, of just a lot of harsh words, of a lot of things, of a lot of behavior that now I know better and would not tolerate. But at the time, again, I was young. I just thought that this was the way of the world. Yeah. And I tolerated it.
And unfortunately, and I think it's important for our listeners to understand that in these kinds of groups, especially in the United Pentecostal Church and a lot of churches that are high control or cult groups, what you have is a man typically at the top of the hierarchy, the organizational chart, that centers himself as the voice of God. Mm-hmm. And the sole arbiter of what is true and what isn't, what is acceptable, what isn't in the group, and then is allowed and encouraged and applauded and rewarded for yelling and screaming and berating not only the group of people collectively, right, on a Sunday morning or a Sunday night, and the harsher the words, the more profound the preacher is thought to be in, mm-hmm. in many of these instances, but then behind the scenes as well, being dismissive, being accusatory, and downright verbally abusive of the staff and of the people that are serving the church, because they feel like they're entitled to take out their frustrations because they are the leader, and they're doing it in the name of God. They're doing it in the name of the church, in the name of truth. And so they feel like any behavior is justified because their goals are pure and their intentions are good. And we see this behavior repeated over and over again in these high control groups.
Yeah. And that's exactly what it was. And it was something that was expected, and it was something that people kind of received and went on with it. And that was something that I didn't understand. And there are circumstances that I look back on and times whenever I wanted to push back. Like and there are times I did push back, and then I was only met with more of the same. And so I learned, like, it's just better, like this is over quicker if I don't say anything. Like, I mean, I remember there was an instance where he was saying something to me and it was wrong. Like, it wasn't, like, it was just, it was not what was happening. He was saying that I was doing something that I was not doing. And I tried to say, well, like, no, I'm not, like, I'm not being defensive about this. I'm trying to explain to you whatever, whatever, whatever. And he yelled at me in his office. Like, he raised his voice at me and yelled at me and was like, I'm right. And just like went. And I'm, and so I'm just like, and so it scared me. And so, cause I mean, this is a big dude. This dude's like, you know, 6'4", you know, 300 something pounds. It scared the crap out of me. Like, I mean, you know, I was like, okay. And it's not like I necessarily thought that he was going to be physically violent with me, but just the imposing figure that this person cut, I was like, oh my God. Like, I was intimidated. And so then I just learned, I just don't, like, if he's going to be in this mode, I just don't say anything.
Which is a trauma response in and of itself, right? Yeah. So people that are conditioned to this kind of behavior eventually, you know, stop pushing back. And so eventually these leaders end up with yes people around them that are that only rubber stamp whatever mm-hmm. the pastor says. And then the pastor is justified for getting angry, for getting upset. I remember hearing a story about Mark Driscoll at Seattle when they were having a spontaneous baptism, and the staff ran out of towels, and Driscoll literally grabbed a staff member by the throat and physically assaulted him. But he did it in the name of, we've got to save these souls. They've got to be baptized. And so he attempted to justify that kind of behavior. And so, unfortunately, what you experienced, lots of people experience in these high control religious groups, because the leader feels exceptional, they feel special, and they feel entitled to treat people however the hell they want to, mm-hmm. based upon the ends justifying the means.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so, you know, I've mentioned before that, you know, I'm a repeat high control group person. And something that, you know, that I realize about that is that the other groups that I was part of felt safe compared to that. And so, you know, with the stuff that's going on at the International House of Prayer in Kansas City, I have a lot of friends who are processing the trauma of finding out that the leader of that ministry, likely over the course of about 40 or 50 years, sexually abused many women. There's the what is happening, what's coming out, is horrific in many ways. And so, but this person, he was a nice guy. Like, I mean, everybody that talks about Mike Bickle, like, and you're like, would he do something like this? I mean, pretty much every person is like, no, he wouldn't be like a sex offender like that, right? I wasn't directly involved with IHOP, but I was directly involved with other, with another house of prayer, with actually two other kind of house of prayer typed ministries. And something that I realized is that, and this isn't, you know, to do like, you know, trauma Olympics or anything like that, but what I realized is some of the things that like my friends, my IHOP friends explained to me about kind of being part of IHOP and kind of what drew them, why they stayed, and then some of the abuses and stuff that they experienced, there's some overlap definitely that I did not experience in those contexts. But then for me, like something like IHOP looks safe. It like, even though like there was, you know, weirdness, there was like kind of a high control aspect to it where, you know, where their thing was, you know, praying 24/7, praying 24 hours a day, not individuals doing that, but kind of having corporate prayer meetings for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And, some of the ministries that I was involved in that were kind of, looked to IHOP or were adjacent to IHOP, or even you had IHOP leaders come and be part of, the ministry. It was a lot of the abuses took place in the name of perpetuating this, feeding this machine and keeping prayer going. And a lot of so one ministry that I was involved in particular, I've called it like the furnace before. At the furnace, like we didn't have 24/7 prayer. We had like 18 hours a day, 5 days a week, and then eventually 6 days a week. And then we would have times whenever we would have 24/7, but it would be like, you know, a week or two or something like that where we would be 24/7. But there was still very much like this culture of we've got to, you know, keep this thing going. And, you know, we want to keep this thing going. And we had, like a lot of interns and that type of thing, who would come and who would want to participate in the ministry, and, they would be mistreated. And it wasn't, always like an overt, like people yelling at them or whatever, even though, it's my understanding that that did happen to some people. It was more in the abuses of like, we're like, you know, we're going to say, you know, that like, I'm trying to think of like an example. Think of like the weirdest example that I can think about. So there was a guy who came through who was like, yeah, you know, y'all shouldn't be drinking Starbucks because Starbucks funds Planned Parenthood and we're supposed to be pro-life and all this other type of stuff. Like, why are you giving your money to this? So then but what's funny is that like, there was a Starbucks, like literally like across the way from the missions base at one point. And like I passed the and so the missions base was actually in two different places over time. But most people had to pass Starbucks on their way to the prayer room. And so it's like, wait a minute, you're preaching against something that like, I mean, a lot of us stop by Starbucks like a lot of us, like, especially like if you're on mornings or something like that, like you're going to stop by Starbucks to get some coffee. But like, you're telling us that we shouldn't do this, or things that were just like really super controlling. Like, again, it wasn't ever. So the thing that what was hard for me to clock coming out of the UPC is that because it wasn't written down on a piece of paper and enforced and said like, you know, you can't be on the platform if you do this and that, I just sort of took it as like, okay, this is optional. Like, I don't have to do that. Like, I'm grown. I'm gonna drink whatever coffee I want to drink. God ain't telling me not to drink Starbucks. So guess what? Like, I'm gonna have my chai latte. Because that's not what the Holy Ghost is telling me. And so like, I kind of felt a sense of independence within this. Like, I wasn't out here. So whenever I was hearing things like, oh, you know, yeah, you shouldn't drink Starbucks. Whenever I was hearing things like, oh, like, you know, watching a lot of television is bad. So it wasn't that, you know, oh, you can't have a TV in your house and like, oh, you know, it's all evil. But it's like, oh, you know, we want to press into Jesus. Do you want to, you know, get rid of anything that would hinder love, that would hinder your relationship with Jesus? I'm like, okay, but, you know, we live a hop, skip, and a jump from Washington, D.C. and my husband work up there. If a terrorist come and blow something up, I want to be able to watch CNN and know what's mm-hmm. going on. Like, I'm gonna have a TV. And guess what? I'm gonna have cable. And guess what? Like, I'm gonna be watching my shows. I'm gonna be watching Downton Abbey. I'm gonna be watching, you know, the shows that I watched at the time. And like, so I think that just being part of some of these other groups, I because of the UPC, because of having that experience at first, I was very kind of like, just I say resistant. It wasn't like I was out here like trying to resist anything, but it was just like, oh, like, I'm not doing that. Thank you. And I just kind of saw some of the stuff as optional, but like, I look back and I'm like, that really wasn't optional. And a lot of people, right, didn't feel like it was like some of these things were optional. And then you have people who, like, you know, we fasted a lot. I mean, or some people fasted a lot. I would participate in fast, but I would be like, you know, okay, cool, I'm gonna, you know, not eat anything. No, I can't do that. I'm hungry. I'm gonna do Daniel fast where I can eat, but it's not even gonna be a full Daniel fast because I'm gonna eat eggs. I need eggs. I need some kind of protein,
right,
up in this. But, you know, hey, I'm giving up meat. And like, mm-hmm. it's whatever. But you have people who didn't even have the option to say that, who didn't even have the agency. I mean, you have people living like literally like where we lived, it had a lot of townhouses and stuff. And so the ministry, the people, there were people that, you know, donated townhouses and stuff to us. And so you'd have like, you know, 6 or 8 people literally just living on top of one another in like a 3-bedroom townhouse. And like one car maybe between 8 people. And like a lot of like your movements and stuff were predetermined by the prayer room schedule, different leadership type of things or whatever. And I look back at it and it wasn't necessarily true for me, but it was true for a lot of people that it was a really like oppressive environment. And yeah.
And you know what's interesting about these kinds of groups, and whether it's the United Pentecostal Church or other high control groups, is that a lot of the behavior that they expect provides the illusion of really making a difference in the world. So it is in their best interest as leaders to keep the people that are involved sleep deprived, busy, hungry, because all of these particular actions and behaviors mimic the feelings that we would experience naturally if we were actually making a difference in the world. But when you look at all of these regulated behaviors and you look around and you think to yourself, or you ask someone in the group, what actual difference are we making in the world or in our neighborhood besides just empowering our leadership and perpetuating our church and the existence of our building and funding the pastor's vision or the leader's vision? I think a lot of these groups endeavor to keep people busy or distracted with fasting or praying or staying awake or staying busy because it provides the illusion that, hey, look, we're actually doing something. We're making a difference because we're experiencing all of this. But when you boil it down to the fact that when you look around the neighborhood or when you look around the country, there's still injustice, there's still inequality, there's still war, there's still people hating on one another. And yet we're not making a difference in all of this. In fact, in a lot of these instances, we're applauding the very means of people killing one another and actually discriminating and marginalizing one another. I think there's something to be said if you feel tired and you feel worn out and you feel hungry, but your group isn't actually impacting the world in any measurable way.
Yeah. And you know, that is exactly like I think about like with the furnace, and even for that matter, the other group that I was part of called The Wall. It was a lot of it was really, whenever you get down to it, it was sinister. I don't think that individuals who were involved with it, or even some of the leaders necessarily, I don't think that that was their aim or goal necessarily to be sinister. And the reason why I say that is that I recognize that things like IHOP, things like the furnace, and even the wall, if I really get down to it, a lot of those things existed, a lot of that movement, that prayer movement, that white Christian prayer movement exists in service to white Christian nationalism. And at the time, like getting into it, I didn't know that. I literally thought, like, again, I signed up to worship Jesus, fam. Like, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I'm going to IHOP because, you know, I'm driving 3 hours from Springfield up to Kansas City, like whenever I could. I'm going to IHOP because there is a 24-hour prayer room where I can just go in and I can pray and I can hear, like, you know, some worship music. Cause I mean, they have some bangers. Like IHOP, I'm not gonna lie, they have some music that was bangers. And like I can go in here and I can hear, you know, like you good, like skilled musicians play music and be in an atmosphere of praise and prayer and worship. Like, sign me up for that. That sounds fantastic. And so that's what like got me. But then as like I'm getting deeper into the culture, I'm realizing, oh, so y'all are praying. And whenever you say that you're praying for justice, your idea of justice is the elimination of abortion. And okay, so even you're going to get me on that, because like you're saying that Margaret Sanger was a racist and that Planned Parenthood is trying to kill Black people off. Oh my gosh. I like you have no reason to lie about that, right? So like you have no reason to exaggerate that, right? So oh my gosh, like Planned Parenthood's trying to kill Black people off. They're intentionally putting Planned Parenthood in the hood in order to eliminate Black people and make it accessible and blah 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 blah. And like there were just so many like myths and lies that they would tell us. It's like, Planned Parenthood, has like whatever. And I'm like, fam, like, because this is something that I even like Googled whenever I lived in Chicago. I wasn't believing any of that at this point, but I was just like, I'm just gonna see, since I'm in this big city, I'm gonna Google Planned Parenthood. And I'm like, Planned Parenthood, like the closest Planned Parenthood is like on the southwest side. I'm sure that I can't remember what neighborhood it's in. It might not even be, if it's not in Inglewood, then it's probably not even in the city. If y'all were really like wanting to make Planned Parenthood just like acceptable, like accessible rather, they would be everywhere. But most of the Planned Parenthoods are like up north or like in the suburbs or something like that. So if you're really trying to get Black people, then like I need y'all to have at least as many Planned Parenthoods as there is Harold's Chicken here, or JJ Fish and Chicken on the south side. But anyway, but that's besides the point. But like so then I'm hearing like, oh okay, I got in like whenever Obama was president. So there's all this stuff that I'm like, yo, that kind of feels racist. Like y'all are saying this stuff, and I mean, you might not mean it, but like that way, but it's given racism. It's given all these different things. And anyway, like there were so many things that as I got into it and as I got deeper into the culture, I started to see like, this isn't just about praying and worshiping. Like you all really see yourselves as part of this narrative that then is promoting Christian nationalism. But then like a lot of these people who were leading some of the things that I was part of, even it's like, okay, you've grown up in culture war Christianity. You've grown up outside of DC and constantly, hearing these types of things, and people, your church going on trips to go to the Supreme Court to pray for against this and that and the fourth. And so like, you don't know a faith outside of this faith that has a lot of Christian nationalist overtones to it. And that was something that once I started to see it, I couldn't unsee it. And it was very kind of difficult and disheartening. And that was the reason, honestly, why I even disconnected from that movement, is because there got to be a point when it's like there are aspects where it's like, okay, I'm just kind of I'm tolerating this because I want to see people pray and worship and whatever. And okay, I'm like, but there just got to be a point whenever it was just kind of like, okay, but like, this is who these people are. Like, this is like, it's not just about it's they're saying that it's about Jesus being worthy and all these other types of things, but really, like, at the end of the day, the things that we care about, the things that we're propagating and promoting, it's really to these like political ends. And I just don't agree with that. And so I had to see myself out. And so then with that, the high control stuff starts to show up when you're expected to vote that way. You're expected to like live your life in a way. So people, would say things like, oh, well, we should just be so pro-life that we're just going to have kids and whatever, whatever, whatever. And I'm like, no. this is my uterus. Like, I'm going to do with my uterus what I see fit. So like, birth control, like that's like an abortion. No, like, look, I had a C-section. I am not going to get pregnant again for at least 18 months, because that's what my gynecologist is telling me, that I could freaking die if like I could have a uterine rupture and die if I get pregnant again. So guess what? I'm going to take these birth control pills. I don't care who and what is being aborted. Like it did that, because first of all, like that's not what's happening because science,
right?
But because first of all, like, you know, Jesus be a basic biology textbook for some of these folks, number one, but anyway, I'm like, I don't care what it could possibly, whatever. I'm trying to live. I am trying to live. And so there's just all these little things that I would see. And I'm just like, no, y'all are really trying to control people. And it's not controlling people in the same way as the UPC, where it was like, you know, you can't do this, you can't whatever. But it was trying to control people, really, even in a way that's maybe a little bit more sinister, because it's like trying to control your conscience and trying to make your conscience be like where the UPC was about controlling your behavior. And it was about, and it was straight up just, and I mean, and you know the people like in the church that, like, you know, people would do the bare minimum of what they, of whatever. And it was weird. There were no real convictions, because as soon as you got another pastor, as soon as you went to another church and they preached something different, then you were like, oh, okay, cool. You know, we can do that now. Like we can, and whatever. These people like really tried to go for your conscience and really tried to go for like your inner life and what you thought and how. So as opposed to, like, you know, we talk about the bite model, and where there's, you know, behavior, information, thought, and emotional control. The UPC was definitely like behavior control. The prayer movement, like IHOP, the furnace, the wall, it was absolutely like thought control. And so it was at that level, like thought and emotional control, or thought and information control. Well, yeah. And, you know, I think that people who are on the ground in the movement don't see that. I think that often I saw it, I think a lot of it because of my proximity to DC. And so seeing where it's like, I remember one time somebody coming into the furnace, and it's like they weren't telling us how to vote, but they were basically telling us how to vote. And I thought that that was weird. Like, it was basically like, we're going to go through all these different issues. And I was just like, okay, that's like really interesting that you're doing that. And I remember a moment for me that, like, really, because I was always like not that pro-life. Like, I personally, so my thing with pro-life was like, yeah, I don't think that I could have an abortion. I don't think that I could do that. But I always viewed abortion as like, this is a form of health care for people. And I always saw it like, so if we don't want for people to use abortion as birth control, because that's always the narrative that people have, but that's not even true. That by and large isn't true. So my mindset was like, okay, if we're pro-life, we're going to make sure that people have access to birth control, that people have access to good sex ed, that people have access to healthcare, and that would allow them to be able to make decisions about their fertility and whatnot. And what I saw, though, was, okay, well, we're pro-life, but we also don't want you, we also want abstinence only sex ed. Well, I'm sorry, but that doesn't, but that crap don't work. And like, okay, you know, we're pro-life, but we're going to also flip out about condoms in schools. And it's like, bruh, like that's how you prevent like giving people, again, giving people access to birth control and letting people control their fertility. So I saw all of these, just like these morally inconsistent things that I was just like, okay, like I could never do this myself. I don't think. But I also don't think that I should be telling other people what to do with their bodies. And then like one of the things that kind of even crystallized for me was whenever I was pregnant with my first daughter, and I had to have a, and I had to have an ultrasound, and they on TV, that's a lie. They don't put the little Doppler thing on your belly and rub it. That's a lie. It's a transvaginal ultrasound, fam. Like, and you can Google that if you don't know what it is. But there was like legislation that I remember that people were pushing for to try to get passed, to like, oh, you have to, like, it was like the heartbeat bill, that kind of thing, where it was like, you know, you have to get an ultrasound, blah, 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 blah. Well, I never, I mean, at first it's like, I have never had a baby before. So I'm like, okay, I mean, I guess, like, you know, because people would just do an ultrasound anyway. I don't see how this is any different. Cause you mean, if somebody's pregnant, you're just going to do an ultrasound, right? So like, okay, fine. You make an ultrasound mandatory. That's probably like not going to hurt anything. Fam, after I had my first ultrasound, my first transvaginal ultrasound, I was like, absolutely the F not. Like, you can't do that. Like, what about a woman that's been abused or raped in some type of way? Like, it was traumatizing for me, and I was there willingly to do, like, that was, and that was like, ooh, this sucks. I could imagine putting somebody else through that. Like, I'm there because I want to be. What about somebody who don't want to be there? She don't want to have that baby, and she don't want to whatever. And yeah. you trying to be like, oh, well, sorry, you know, we've got to stick this wand someplace. Like, is that really a pro-life stance? And so there were just like that's a tangent, but like there were all of these things that I started to see that was like, y'all are saying one thing, but then that stance is not consistent. Or the stance is consistent, but it's consistent in that it's controlling, in that like, okay, we're going to be so pro-life that we're not even going to use birth control because that could this and that and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, yo, that could put people in danger. Like, that advice could put somebody in danger. And so I saw that then playing out where within like broader national politics, where it's like, I'm seeing leaders who are showing up at the houses of prayer, who are on the speaking circuit for all these different things. I'm also seeing those people cuddling up to politicians. And I'm seeing, like, you know, some of the actions that people are wanting to take is to show up in these different political spaces and whatever. And I'm just like, kind of like, you know, but like, and there was no room for disagreement. There was no room for healthy dissent. There was no, like, if you had a question, like, well, wait a minute. Like, what? Yeah. Well, wait a minute. What about like rape or incest? Are we really saying that? People would be like it was like, you know, oh my God, like that heresy, whatever. And so there was no real room for dissent. There was no real room for, you know, robust intellectual discussion, because you would just get, and if it wasn't necessarily by leadership, it was by other people. People would just treat you really badly if they didn't think that you fit their brand of orthodoxy within the group. And that in itself was abusive. But going back to that white supremacy angle, what I started to see was like, this isn't just people in a prayer room someplace praying. What's happening is indoctrination, and people are being radicalized then in that prayer room, by the prayers that are being prayed, by the messages that are being preached. People are being radicalized and then mobilized to act as political agents, as to be actors for a political cause. But it's all couched in spiritual language. So you don't realize, like, something like IHOP, it's as much a political cult as it is a spiritual cult.
Right.
As it is a religious cult. And that was something that, again, you know, I didn't realize it until I was in it and saw.
What Ali has detailed for us today is the fact that even people with the best of intentions can end up in some of these high control groups where you are on the receiving end of this trauma that continues to be perpetuated. And I want to recommend to all of our listeners, if you haven't done so already, pick up a copy of Ali's book, I Won't Shut Up, because in the pages of her book, she details even in greater detail some of the trauma that she experienced at the hands of these particular groups. And Ali, this brings us to the end of this particular episode, but we're going to continue this conversation on the High Control Podcast. But I want to encourage everyone that's listening, if you benefit from the content that you're hearing, give us a thumbs up, subscribe, share this content with someone else, and give us a rating and tell us how this particular content is encouraging you, is benefiting you, is informing you, because that helps us continue this important work. Ali, thanks so much for sharing your story, and I'll give you the last word today.
Yeah, well, you know, thank you all for listening to my rambling today. If you are someone that maybe you're starting to be at the place where you're realizing, oh, maybe the church or the religious group or, you know, whatever it is group that I'm a part of is kind of leaning some of the ways that you're talking about in this episode, you can get out. You can leave. I'm not saying that it'll be easy, but you can leave. You can say no. You can reject those things. It's okay to ask questions. It's okay to deliver pushback. And if it's not safe to do that, then it's a group that's probably not safe to be in.
Thank you so much, Ali, for that. And thank you all for listening and tuning in to this episode of the High Control Podcast. For my friend, Ali Henney, I'm Scott Lloyd. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to High Control. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to our show. You can catch us on social media at High Control Pod. Check the show notes for resources and how to get in touch. Stay in control, friends.